Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You know, when Joe outreached to you and Rachel, we pretty much were at our wit's end. Where do we go from here? No one's listening to us. And I think that the police department thought, well, we're just going to go away. And that didn't happen. And we didn't get the compassion from the police department. It wasn't until you and Rachel came into our lives that we finally saw compassion. We saw two people who we didn't know that were total strangers want to tell Joey's story. We didn't get that from the people in our community. Through that, we've shared a lot of laughs. There's been a lot of sad moments. You've invested a lot of time and money. This is not just a story to you and Rachel. This is from your heart. And we do not, as a family, know how to say thank you enough. I know Joey's looking down, and I'm sure he's coming to you and Rachel and pulling some of his shenanigans. But we wouldn't be where we were if it wasn't for you and Rachel. And God bless both of you, and keep up the great work, and stay with True Crime, and help many, many, many more families like you're helping us.
Hundreds of hours of interviews and research, 3 separate trips to Buffalo, New York, and 14 episodes later, here we are, with piles of evidence and firsthand accounts on record of the Buffalo Diocese's deadly tactics. We've had priests and policemen reach out to us to say Father Joe did not kill himself. We have established the extraordinary circumstances surrounding Father Joe's death. His personal doctor went on record to state he did not appear to be depressed or even capable of such a selfish act. He bought a lottery ticket hours before his death, paid his taxes the day before. He had called to confirm future plans that morning. His computer, fax machine, and filing cabinet were taken by the diocese before police arrived. Despite all of that, the most damning evidence is that Father Joe was shot behind his left ear with a gun that was turned into police 14 years earlier. And considering the trajectory of the bullet and Father Joe's bum left hand, his non-dominant hand, firing the lethal shot himself would have required him to contort his body in such an awkward manner that any logical person would be skeptical. And famed criminal pathologist Cyril Wecht, who performed the second autopsy, said, "I've been a pathologist for 55 years. I can't tell you I've ever seen a case where a right-handed person with a crippled left hand would be able to shoot himself from that angle." And then there's the deacon, who shouldn't have even been at the church that Saturday afternoon, yet he shows up to a door that is always unlocked with keys, because that day the door was locked. Then the deacon proceeds to recount key details of discovering Father Joe's dead body differently. When he found Father Joe in his rectory, He was with Matthew Lukes, a parishioner and good friend of Father Joe. When Deacon Paul walked up the stairs to the rectory, he shouted to Matthew, "Oh my God, there is a gun on the floor." And presumably he was aware Father Joe had passed. Yet in an article Deacon Paul wasted no time being interviewed for, the day after Father Joe's death, he recounts a very different story. The article's by Jill Terreri and Phil Fairbanks from October 15, 2012. Paul Weisenberger saw his friend sitting in the chair and thought he was napping. Quote, "I thought he was asleep," Weisenberger said of Father Joseph F. Moreno Jr. "I pushed the door open and saw him sitting in the chair. I didn't realize it at first, and then I took his pulse." Weisenberger, a pastoral administrator at St. Lawrence Catholic Church, spoke candidly Sunday of the scene he encountered when he found Moreno dead of an apparent suicide inside the rectory. Without revealing too much of what he saw, he mentioned a gun found by Moreno's side. "He took his own life," Weisenberger told reporters. "The investigation is still going on, but from what I know, it's quite clear." That's what Weisenberger said. Okay, let's see here. Later in the article, he's quoted saying, "He found the handgun that killed Moreno wedged between the priest's body and his chair, and only he and Moreno were in the rectory at the time of the priest's death. Weird, because Matthew Lukes was there, and you told him the gun was on the floor. Also, isn't it peculiar that a deacon would be so motivated to go on the record stating it was a suicide only the day after Father Joe's death, before any authority had ruled on the cause of death?" Regardless of Deacon Paul calling the diocese before 911, or his motives for going on the record with the Buffalo News stating that his death was a suicide, money was missing from St. Lawrence Parish, and Father Joe had told Sue that he did not trust Deacon Paul just days before his death, after the missing funds were discovered by an audit. Yet, the police never treated him like a suspect. The gun was never photographed at the scene before it was emptied of bullets and put in an evidence bag by Officer Chris Politska of E-District. So, we are left with multiple conflicting stories of its whereabouts at the crime scene. And as you already know by now, the police work just got worse and worse from there. However, it's important to reiterate that Detective Lima files the police report the night of Father Joe's death as homicide file number 12-163. And it's a good thing we have a copy of this report, because apparently it has disappeared from police records in Buffalo. A little over a month ago, after we returned from Buffalo, we got this email. "I've been listening to this podcast nonstop over the last several days, and I've been obsessed. I'm from Buffalo and work for the Buffalo Police Department. I was hired after this incident happened. I've been looking into it a little bit and asking around. I'd like to stay completely anonymous, but I thought it was super odd because I tried looking up the police report out of curiosity, and there isn't one. I found the incident as it was called in, but I don't know why there wouldn't be a police report written on the incident. The actual file would be stored in the homicide office, and only homicide detectives would have access to that area, or a select few in upper administration. Also, the reason it's a homicide file is because the homicide detectives investigate all major incidents involving deaths. Mostly homicide cases, but they also respond to overdoses, suicides, or any suspicious unattended death. That may explain the homicide filing. But why is it missing now? And remember, Detective Lima's report mentions 2 wounds. It's hard to break through Flynn's brick wall. Buffalo is a theocracy, after all, and the diocese has been reigning over Western New York with impunity for decades. Thanks to the brave work of Channel 7's Charlie Specht and Church Militant's Christine Niles, the Attorney General of New York finally stepped up in 2020 and filed a lawsuit against the Buffalo Diocese, Bishop Malone, and Auxiliary Bishop Grosch for mishandling child sexual abuse claims and failing to uphold their responsibilities to victims of abuse, parishioners, and the public. However, to no one's surprise, much hasn't changed under Bishop Fisher's new direction. With legal protection of a biased DA's office, whether or not this protection is bought and paid for, or purely persistent on the faith of John Flynn, it seems the Buffalo Diocese cannot be taught or learn its lesson.
A source from WKBW had told me in the midst of the clergy sex abuse with the Diocese of Buffalo that R. Smith had conveyed to him that if the Diocese of Buffalo didn't give him what he wanted, he was going to go to the media and expose what really happened to Father Joe Marino. In other words, a sort of blackmail. So, in speaking with this person, I asked him if I should call him. He said that was up to me. So in the process, Art had called our family home a minimum of 3 times. The second time, our family pastor was at the house, and he told me to stay away from Art Smith, that he's no good. So with that, I didn't pursue speaking to him. He did make one final attempt at calling the house. Dad was a little nasty. He said, "What do you want? Money?" And with that, that's the last that I have heard from our Smith. I don't know what he knows. As everyone in this diocese knows what happens, he may very well know what really happened to Father Joe, but unless he talks to us, we'll never know.
Allegedly, if Art Smith's crimes were not covered up by the diocese and his pension not reinstated, presumably he was going to blow the whole thing open and go to the media revealing what the diocese really did to Father Joe. Sue told me that lead months ago, and I thought it was huge, earth-shattering, in fact, but I wasn't sure how to get him to talk, especially after knowing Joe Sr., and rightfully so, hung up on him. So I put it on the shelf, until a few weeks ago. I received an email from Art's niece, Gina, a woman who we will hear from momentarily, who had tuned into Deadly Diocese just a few weeks prior and fired off an email. And what she had to say was extremely revealing, and actually chilled me to my bones. Gina is also a woman who's now become a brave soul sister, trying to get Sue and I as much information as possible in hopes of uncovering more to get justice for Joey. Here's Gina.
Hi. Hey, how's it going?
It's going crazy. This is Gina Sapirsky. I am the oldest niece of Father Art Smith. When he went away to the seminary, my mom and dad separated when I was very young, so we moved into his bedroom when he went away, and he would come and go quite often with his priest friends. My grandmother's sister was also a nun, so the Catholicism was the overarching theme of our family, like from day one. And you know, we were all named after saints. Everybody's first name had to be named after a saint. You went to church every Sunday. Catholicism was, you know, what we all revolved around. And you know, with Father Art Smith having a nun as an aunt, you know, my grandmother believed in all of the Catholicism, and she lived and breathed it more genuinely than anyone I've ever bumped into. She was the most angelic human. So, you know, having a priest in the family was a badge of honor, and you really tried to live your life to make sure that you didn't get scolded by Father Art. That was something you were always worried about. It was always in the back of your mind, like, am I going to get in trouble all the time? So that was, for him to be the most saintly person was something that everybody put a lot of effort into, that being the impression. But there was some cracks in that for me from my first memory of him. My first memory of him, he was like teasing my cousin and I, two little girls that were 5 or 6 years old, and making us sob, crying, like terrifying us. And I could hear right now, I can still hear his sinister laugh, that making us cry in fear and terror was hilarious to him. So that was my first memory. And then, you know, my parents split, which, whatever, that has nothing to do with Artie. However, my dad never got along with him, never trusted him, and always would put a bug in my ear to, you know, don't trust that guy, I don't like that guy, that kind of thing. And as I got older, he would explain a little further that he and my mother went out to our cottage out in Rushford in the wintertime, where, you know, it's on a stone trail, no plows, no phones. The phones are turned off in the summer or in the winter. Anyway, he goes out there in the winter before I was born with my mom, and he walks into the white cottage, and there's Artie and another priest and a bunch of altar boys at a, quote, retreat. That didn't sit well with my dad, and he told me that that bothered him, you know, as I got older, and he could talk a little bit more about it. But knowing what I know now about Artie's accusations, that's a huge red flag. Like, that's a much different story decades later, you know. So, and then actually my little brother, he's like 12 or 13 years younger than me, when I was away in college for a year, I have another brother and a sister now from my mom's second marriage, and I would always try and, you know, keep them away from him, and I always thought, like, maybe we're safe from him because he really doesn't like us. Like, he clearly doesn't like me. He's mean to my brother. He's mean to my mother. I feel like we're safe from him, right? So I didn't worry too much about my little brother and sister, but then when I was away in college for a year, during that time, apparently he got to my little brother. And I didn't find out about it until, you know, probably 20 years later. About 10 years later, I heard like a little something from my mother where she said, you know, Artie won't leave Ryan alone, and he keeps emailing him, and he's kind of like stalking him or something. He's being real weird, and he always asks about Ryan when I run into him, and then he'll say, why does Gina hate me so much? So that was always the conversation. The other two siblings never came into it. It was always like, how's Ryan doing? What is he, you know, how he would ask about Ryan, and then he would say, why is Gina hate me so much? And those were the two things about our family that he kind of stuck on. And so my mother makes some comment about, you know, he's being real weird to Ryan or whatever. And she goes, I don't know, I just told him to stay away from him. Stay away from him. So now my brother's getting more and more into drug abuse and weird issues, like just not surviving well. He's clearly something's up, right? So then we start to see a few things on the news about diocese and whatever, and in the movie Spotlight comes out, and this summer comes along that my mom's telling me that, like, Ryan just cries every day. He cries every day. He doesn't stop. I don't know what to do. He's just crying all the time. Well, during this summer, we had a wedding to go to, and it was way out in Eden. And already was supposed to do the ceremony. I can't remember what year this is, but this is probably 14 or 15-ish. So he's supposed to do the ceremony, but he's living out in an apartment in Williamsville and not at a parish or anything. So it's a little confusing. And anyway, so everybody gets to the church. The church is full to the brim, 100 degrees in there, and nobody, Artie's nowhere to be found. He was still at home in Williamsville, which is a good 40, 45-minute drive to where this church is. And he's there, and he's drunk, and it's like 2 in the afternoon when the wedding is supposed to be happening, and he's still passed out. So he jumps in his car, drives there as fast as he can, probably DWI-worthy, I don't know. And long story short, all of that was driving my little brother crazy. What the? I can't believe that we're still dealing with this guy, and I can't believe it. And he's getting, like, really agitated and upset about this, right? So that was the catalyst for him to come and say, like, why are we all dealing with this guy still? We're still letting him perform the marriages and everything else. He's the worst. And he says, you know, he molested me. And he said, I told mom a long time ago and she didn't do anything about it. And I honestly think my mom just wasn't, I don't know if she believed it. I don't know. I don't know if she understood the severity of what had happened to him. So anyway, he was about 9 years old at the time. And somehow already ended up in the same bedroom as him, like either out at our cottage or at one of our relatives' houses, and he sat next to him on the bed and started telling him, you know, how, oh, you're getting so grown up, and kind of saying nice things to him, and then he started touching him, and Ryan said he wanted to, like, climb under the bed. He was, like, thinking about how he was going to get away and hide under the bed and all this stuff. So that was when I found out that he had done that for the first time, and I was devastated. This was probably in 2017 that he told me, and I was just crushed because I had really believed that, you know, if I make sure that he hates me, he won't come anywhere near any of us, right? Like, and I just genuinely didn't like him. I didn't want him around. I didn't want anyone that I cared about to be anywhere near him, but nobody could understand that. Like, they would just see the collar, and they wouldn't see the devil that I saw. So that's my experience with Artie. I've lived with him my whole life. He's been at every holiday, every wedding, funeral, get-together, everything. And it's all weird. Every instance is weird. I could give you a weird story about every one of them. Now, my husband and I have been together for, since 97. Okay. So, the first time he ever met Artie was out at our cottage at Rushford, where, now our family owns probably 10 or 12 cottages out there at this point. Our first one was my great grandparents got the first cottage out there a good 65 years ago, or maybe 70 at this point. So, Rushford is a big part of our family story. So I take my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, out to Rushford, and, you know, he's a Catholic kid, went to all Catholic school, went to St. Francis High School, went to Canisius College, all Catholic, right? So, you know, what could possibly be wrong with him? What's already going to find wrong with him? Not that I gave a hoot, but, you know, he always finds something wrong. Like, he'll call you by the name of an ex-boyfriend or something on purpose, like, just to be a dig, just to, like, get you with a stick of, just get under your skin, you know? So anyway, we're out at our cottage, and we're walking towards the cottage, and Artie gets out of the car, and I'm like, oh, shit, Artie's here. Excuse my language, but I wasn't excited to see him, to be honest. So he walks up to Jeff and I, and he says, where'd you two sleep last night? Like, giving us shade for, you know, what are you two sleeping together? And I don't know, just weirdo. Like, why does your mind go to that? You don't want to say, hi, my name's Ari, you know, not a normal introduction. So we look over, and he's got these two little boys in the car. I should say little boys, but they're probably 12 or 13-ish, and, you know, very dark skin. And my aunt, who co-owns that cottage with him, she's a Spanish teacher. So she's like, oh, they're seminarians from Colombia. And she's talking their ear off because she speaks Spanish. And so I know that, you know, these two boys are there with him. It bothers me. I don't like that they're there with him. I'm thinking of that story of my dad telling me him having these kids out there for a retreat in an overnight. And now this cottage is like an hour away from Buffalo. And like I said before, no phone lines in the wintertime. So like if there was an emergency, there wouldn't even be a way to call back then, you know, back in the day, because there were no cell phones even. So anyway, so this is bothering me that he's got these two boys out here and he's got them far away from the city and where they're meant to be or where they're staying or anything. And so that story sticks with me for a real long time, right? So then Ryan comes into my store, my husband and I own a store, and we're sitting at the counter and he's finally tells the whole entire story to me and he's sobbing, like just falling apart on the desk and just inconsolably crying. And my mom had said, you know, he's been crying all summer. He cries every day, ever since that wedding. Like it just really got at him. Right. So I said, listen, my friend has a friend at Channel 2. Do you want me to see if I can get an interview? And so you can, you know, tell your story. And Ryan said, yes, let's do it. So Claudia Ewing from Channel 2 agrees to do an interview with him and brings us downtown to Channel 2. I drive my mom and him, and we go, and he does the interview. And in the beginning, he's like, he has these, like, stress-induced seizures, so he's ticking, and I call it glitching, but he's like little mini seizures because he's so panicked. And so he gets through the story and he bursts into tears, and then he's speaking like perfectly fluid without any stuttering or hiccups, or it was just amazing watching that release from him. It was amazing. So now that was a very trying visit, right? Like I'm crying. My other aunt comes into my store and is screaming and yelling at me. And I can't believe you would do this to your family. And so I'm the bad guy, right? So I'm all swollen and crying. And I teach these computer classes on Tuesday nights. And I have one of the two husbands is telling me the story, not both of them, one of them. And he says, you know, I grew up in the first ward, and all the priests would have us, like, do jobs around the rectory. They would kind of be able to, they would recognize the ones of us that were gay and try and keep them close, right? So he says, you know, we'd do the dishes and paint and do work around the rectory. And then, so one day the priest, and I asked him if it was my uncle, and he said no, so this was a different priest. One day he puts a couple of the boys that would help around the rectory in the car and takes them for a ride out to a cabin. He tells me that he goes all the way out to the end of the 400 where it ends, and it turns into Route 16. And they drove for, you know, a little while longer, and then they turned right just once, and they drove for a long time. And I'm sorry, they turned left once, and then they turned right over a little bridge and a little creek and then up a big hill. And then they were at the cabin. Now, if I were to tell you, like, my description as a little kid of how to get to our cabin, that was it, to a T. You take the 400 to the end, turns into Route 16, you turn left on 39, and you turn right on Hillcrest, which goes over a little bridge and a little creek, and you go up Dead Man's Curve, which is a very steep curve, and then about 2 minutes later, you're at our cottage. I mean, it was insane. I was like, I didn't know what to say at that point, other than like, thank you for telling me that story. I can't even believe it. I feel like maybe we're at my family's cottage. I don't know. But so now, in this time frame, I'm Googling things and searching on the internet and wondering what else is happening with Artie, because then there was that other Father Richard came forward and his story was out right around the same time as Ryan's, and there was just an awful lot of it on the internet. So I'm kind of Googling and searching around, and I find the Church Militant website, and they have this story about a priest that, and I remember this priest when it was on the news that he died, and they said it was a suicide, but then I see this article that says they don't think it was a suicide. So I'm like, okay, this is interesting, and everything's going on with Artie right now. Now, when I grew up at my grandma's house, after Artie moved out to the rectory and all the priests would come around, everybody that he graduated from Christ the King Seminary with would come over. So, you know, I remember very clearly Frank Tuckles coming over, and I liked him. He was very sweet, but he was like the only one I really felt comfortable around. He was a very nice guy. But Artie graduated with almost all of them are on the list. I mean, the worst ones that he graduated with are the worst ones on the list are ones that he graduated with. And that list includes Bishop Gross. He is his classmate from graduation from, I want to say it was, what year were they ordained? 1971. They were ordained together. And now Gross is supposed to be the one disciplining him when he's got complaints against him for sexual abuse. Gross, he's his BFF. It doesn't make any sense to me that he would be in a supervisory position like that and making decisions. Just ridiculous. So now I know that Artie's got his best friends are in charge of whether or not he gets in trouble. And all of these like stories are starting to come out here and there. And he mentioned to my aunt a story about the bishop accused me of something that didn't happen 43 years ago or whatever. Well, now there's a case in the Child Victims Act of an abuse allegation of a boy that was 16 at the time from St. Bernadette's. They took a bus ride to Washington, D.C., and that poor kid ended up in the same hotel room with Artie. And Artie, he just does the most odd, cryptic, creepy things. Like, his nickname is The Creeper, so that's perfect. And actually, after Ryan came forward and was on the news, Artie started creeping and showing up at his work and driving by out at Rushford, but not stopping where we were. And Ryan had some run-ins with like random people that he didn't recognize, that he like smashed his hands on the hood of the car and like, why are you following me? Leave me alone. Because Ryan walks everywhere. He doesn't drive because of the seizures. So
Who were these people? Like, did you ever find out? Like, who?
No.
They were following him for Artie?
I think they were following him for Artie, and Artie was too. So if Artie couldn't be there, there was somebody else. And this guy was, like, following Ryan real slow in his vehicle, like, going slow behind him while Ryan was walking. And Ryan's senses were a little bit heightened because he had seen Artie's car with the Peace One license plate, which... he's got a vanity plate, so you can't miss it. And by the way, anybody in Buffalo listening to this, if you get an Uber and your license plate is Peace One, don't take that one. That's Artie or Lyft. It's either Uber or Lyft. I don't know which one he's doing at this point. And so this behavior was like the intimidation tactics. It really, you know, reminded me of, like, this wasn't just Artie. Artie wasn't the only problem at this juncture. Now we have operatives like coming in and doing his bidding, and not just Artie following Ryan, but another stranger. And odd things like that would start to happen. So it just seemed organized, you know, like they were doing what they could to keep it off the news. But I think it just happened to be like an overflow that they couldn't control anymore, finally, when it was both Richard and Ryan on the news at the same time, and at the same time as St. Mary's of the Lake story with that little boy that he was creeping, and that story is weird. So anyway, there's at this time Artie was like in hiding, kind of like everybody was looking for him, and Claudine Ewing was trying to find him to respond to Ryan's allegations, and he wouldn't speak to anybody and all this stuff. So he's actually staying at a family friend's cottage out at Rushford. So, but then that family friend, I want to say, and I could have the story wrong, but I want to say he had a heart attack and fell off the dock into the lake and died. And then Artie had nowhere to stay after that. I mean, these weird situation. I know, it's insane. Ryan getting kind of stalked and things like that. This is all going on and everything's kind of heightened. And I run into, and I'm searching on the internet, did anyone else come forward? That kind of thing I'm looking up. And I look on the internet and I find this website called Church Militant. And they have a story about Father Joe Moreno of Buffalo, of the Buffalo Diocese. And was it really a suicide or not, right? So I click on the story and I read it. And it wasn't like Channel 2 or CNN or anything like that. So I'm skeptical. You know, I don't want to believe everything I read on the internet. And then I start reading it. And there's very specific evidence discussed that is part of the case, and real interviews with Sue, who is Father Joe Moreno's twin sister, and all this stuff. And then I'm reading about what could be a possible motive. And they said that in the story I'm reading, that Father Joe Moreno had like a stack of paperwork and was ready to whistleblow on a story about sex abuse, which had to do with trafficking of seminarians from Colombia. And my chin hit the floor, and I immediately remember the seminarians that were there that I got introduced to on the first day that Jeff met Artie. They were out at Rushford. Everybody saw it. Everyone knows about it. And I'm like, the Colombian seminarian story is true. I was like, it's true. This is true. Whatever's going on here, I just believed it. I believed that, okay, no, it wasn't a suicide. It had to be... immediately. I knew he had retreats out there all the time for decades. And I just thought about those Colombians that were in this car in a foreign country, don't speak the language. I don't know if they have cell phones. At the time, this was, you know, before the iPhone, it was a flip phone era, but I didn't know if they had phones at all, and they're just stuck in this car with this guy. It just freaked me out. And then when I read that, I put those two things together instantaneously. So that story always stuck to me like Velcro, right? Like I would always follow up on it and read about it if anything else came up. And a lot of times what'll happen is if I haven't seen Artie in quite some time, I start to like feel good and I stop thinking about him and I don't worry about him and whatever, right? So, but then you run into him and you get triggered, right? So a few weeks ago, my uncle passes away, which is also Artie's brother. So I'm at the wake and who's there but Artie? And I was so annoyed because I knew I wasn't going to do a good job of being there in the same room with him, and I didn't. So that just triggered me, and it set me off on, like, I think if anyone has had like some sort of a trauma that something reminds you of it, you kind of have this like flood of all of that initial trauma comes back. And for me, the trauma wasn't sexual trauma. It was, I am so upset that he got to my brother when I thought I did everything I could to protect him. Like, that's my trauma, right? Like, mm-hmm. I got to grow up with this jerk and he was mean to me and whatever, but like, I thought I was doing a good job of protecting against him and I didn't. So what does it tell you for people that have no idea? They don't see him coming, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, anyway, so I really wanted to find out more about this, and then my cousins and I were texting each other and sending, you know, thoughts back and forth, and, well, look at this. This is weird. Look at that. And so she sends the link to your podcast. And at the time, I didn't know that this was new. Like, I thought I'm going to be listening to something from 2 years ago or whatever. And it's like every name you're bringing up, oh, I've been there. Oh, I remember that. Holy cow, I know this thing. You know, Buffalo is a small city. But so many of the names that you brought up have crossed my path. It's not like I heard of that name. It's like I met that guy. So all this weird stuff is coming up in the podcast, and it's driving me nuts. And I'm like, oh my God, I have to reach out to them. Like, I didn't know how much they knew about the Columbian Seminary and thing. And I just thought, like, I at least have to tell you that I can give first person eyewitness testimony that, yes, he had Columbian Seminarians in his car. It was him and two young boys. And there's multiple witnesses, not just me.
I was speaking with Sue the other day. I mean, frankly, I speak to her most days. We often share leads and ideas. I'll tell her of a breakthrough of a witness who opened up, and she will point me in the direction of another cold lead she exhausted, hoping that maybe a new person, a new voice on the other end. One that, while Sue treats everyone with the most grace and class, decades of pain and unanswered questions and non-return phone calls inevitably comes through on the other end. It's hard to ignore. But what's crazy is, after 2.5 years of working to get justice for Joey, it's hard for me to mask my frustration and the pain I feel for dear Sue and her father, Joe. Because one thing I know for sure is Father Joseph Moreno was murdered. A life of constant care for others and boundless energy and enthusiasm toward the pursuit of others' peace and comfortability, and even with a lighthearted approach to their struggles, a man this world needed was snuffed out for the very reason this world needed him most. To do the right thing, to make sure the pain stops for the victims of the Catholic Church, to make sure the good old boys club of the Buffalo Diocese closes its doors and opens their faith up to a place where good men and good women can thrive and protect the vulnerable, the naive, and the youthful taking their first journey into a future that should have been and should be modeled after the ways of Father Joe. But he was a threat to their organization, their well-oiled system of abuse and cover-up, of channels and systems so intricate, it makes their crimes so quickly silenced and hidden that they don't even get the chance to feel the agony of guilt or shame. It's a network built on shaming ones that go against them instead, shaming the victims, and shaming a church so badly that their flock loses faith. But Father Joe was not one to be shamed. A man that knew who he was and never lived a single day making apologies for that. Because no one needs to apologize for waking up every day and just doing the right thing. Yet, he and his family are the ones who still suffer. Sue told me a story the other day where her dad called Joey Pistol. a youthful nickname he had for his son. And then the 90-year-old man proceeded to break down in tears, saying, "I just miss Pistol." Pistol. I like that. It seems to fit the description of a fighter. A little pistol of a soul, ready to pop when the time is right. Joe Sr. himself is a little pistol, which might be part of the reason why Art Smith, a man from the list of credibly abused, a man we discussed in the first few episodes of the podcast, got a little gun-shy and never called back the Moreno household again. Or maybe it's also partially due to this podcast. A shameful man too afraid of a little pistol like Sue. Or even myself. Or Greg. But here's the thing. The pistol we are using to expose the truth are our words. Our research. Our faith that someone, somewhere, along the lines in this Buffalo legal system will do the right thing. They'll use their words, put their nose to the grindstone, and along the way, balk at the sinister system of the good old boys club who run that church, or the coward that pulled that trigger in the shadows of a priest's rectory, and then slinked away, hiding behind a system set up to protect them. My heart hurts thinking this is the final episode of season one. But it's not the end to this journey. This is so imprinted on our hearts, we are not stopping in our pursuit of justice for Father Joe. But we need your help. Stonewalled is the best way to describe the experience of both Sue Moreno and Leslie Amanda Winkowski's mom. And to add another to the list, Rakisha Lewis, Tyler Lewis's mom. All women bound by one tragic fact. D.A. John Flynn is not getting justice for their loved ones. This is the experience we most recently had while calling the D.A.'s office. And this was the third time in 20 minutes we spoke to this kind receptionist who was truly trying to help. But silence is all we've heard ever since, despite the receptionist going out of her way to hand deliver a note for someone to call us back.
This is District Attorney John Flynn. Our business hours are Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. To speak with me, press 1. For Buffalo City Court, press 2.
Can we speak to you?
District Attorney's office.
I apologize again. I really do. I'm so sorry. But I know you tried to transfer me to Mark Vaughn. He did not answer. Can I ask you just a simple question, please?
Sure.
Can you tell me why I can't have an appointment with Mr. Flynn? Is it like really out of the order?
That's why he has an assistant district attorney's. Unfortunately, it's not something he can do at the moment. I'm not saying he's too busy for other people or not, but that's not his position. He has assistant district attorney who handles those type of cases that have to have those conversations with you, unfortunately.
It's kind of immediately. Not that I'm saying anyone in your office has, but it gets there. So you become hesitant to leave a voicemail because you assume you're not going to get a phone call back.
Understood. Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, I can hand delivery. I don't mind hand delivering a message to Gary Hackbush if you need me, just to tell him if he could call you directly. I mean, I can't really get into, like I said, it's not something that I can get into detail about the case itself. So I can pick on your name and your number personally and say, hey, you know, they're in the name of the victim, just to say, hey, this is a concerned citizen.
As you remember, Amanda Winkowski was found frozen, naked, upside down in a residential trash bin, with strangulation marks around her neck, her hyoid bone broken, multiple people's DNA, including several men's semen on her body. Yet her death was ruled an accidental overdose, and her case never reopened by John Flynn. He avoids the subject. He avoids her mother, Leslie, and the truth at all costs. And when he's not avoiding it, he's fumbling through a defensive, nonsensical argument, similar to when Sue fights for her brother, Joe. And John Flynn's go-to there is a video of Father Joe flipping burgers with his left hand. He claims his hand was fine. He could easily shoot a gun.
We have video of him flipping burgers.
A lightweight spatula and a heavy metal deadly weapon are hardly comparable. And John, that video of Father Joe was taken before his hand was stabbed in a botched robbery, meaning in that video, he had a perfectly good left hand. But you couldn't even care enough to get your facts straight. And Tyler Lewis, the young boy who was stabbed once in the heart by a stranger in a scenario where he was set up by other boys he had just met. John Flynn handled it this way. He held a secret grand jury, orchestrated by him, without the parents knowing any particulars about it, not allowing them to attend, and actually laughing about the fact that he didn't use the two witnesses that they suggested to them. One was Tyler's girlfriend, who knew the parties involved personally, who has an almost hour-by-hour timeline and account of speaking to Tyler that day, and who is so articulate and has records and information John Flynn needs to hear and that grand jury needed to hear. Yet he laughs at him. He laughed about not calling her to the stand, closed the case, and Rakesha Lewis, Tyler's mom, Carla his girlfriend, his father, grandmother, and friends will never know who killed their promising young love. Because John Flynn says he'll never reveal it. And with Father Joe, here are our goals. The way the legal system works and what John Flynn has said with his own mouth, they will take a look at the case again and reopen it if there's new evidence.
If someone brings me any kind of new credible evidence, absolutely I'll look at it. I'll dig right into it.
Well, not only was there new evidence close to a decade ago when famed pathologist Cyril Wecht said he didn't believe it was a suicide and the case needs to be investigated further. Well, that report went unread and collected dust in law enforcement and the DA's office. Well, that coupled with the countless other things Sue uncovered before we came on board, and the new evidence we have uncovered is a mountain of new evidence. So with that being said, our goals are to get John Flynn to reopen Father Joe's case, or to have enough people to sign the petitions for Father Joe, Tyler Lewis, and Amanda Winkowski's cases that he is forced to resign from office. And hopefully those things happen first. Otherwise, in regards to John Flynn, we have to hope that he is not reelected next year and a good, honest DA, not in the pockets of the Catholic Church, comes into office and fights for Father Joseph Moreno. On a lighter note, during this hiatus, we are not giving up, and we are going to be digging behind the scenes. We are going to get justice for Father Joe, so please don't lose faith. Check for updates over at Seven Deadly Sinners. The link will be in the show notes, and please keep sending us any information you may have to deadlydiocese@gmail.com. Sign the petition and spread the word using hashtag justice for Father Joe. And stay foolishly vigilant in the pursuit of the good in the world, the justice that the vulnerable deserve, and have a slice of pizza when you think of Father Joe. Joey liked collecting four-leaf clovers, and Sue's dream is to escape to Ireland for a magical break away from the tragedy that has colored her life. So we've been talking about planning a trip to the Emerald Isle, and if we do, we are going to film this healing journey with Sue. So hopefully, until episode 1, season 2 of Deadly Diocese, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. The sun shine warm upon your face. The rain fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. We love you guys. Thank you endlessly for being on our heart's journey with us. And we will see you very soon.
We're not done fighting for justice for Father Joe, but this is the last episode of season 1. So thank you for listening. And if you're a Buffalo Catholic, remember, when the collection plate comes around this Sunday, you don't have to tithe. And that's probably the quickest way to have your voice heard.